We're going to see how this balancing act does here. All right, so this is Nancy Campbell, and I'm interviewing Dick Milstein on the morning of July 30th. An unbelievably fast-moving month. All right, so what I'd like you to do is start by telling me the story of how you came to be associated with this whole field of drug abuse.
Should I give you the long story, and then you can edit from there?
Yeah, you can go ahead.
More is better, and then you can decide what
exactly.
You want.
Exactly.
Okay. As a youngster, a relative youngster, a teenager, I knew that I wanted to be a psychiatrist. And a psychiatrist in clinical practice, not in research. Research was nothing that was even in my camp. I read things like Freud's interpretation of dreams. Maybe I was unusual in that sense. What I got out of it is something else, perhaps, but this is what I knew. So I went to college knowing this is what I was going to do. And because of my interests, decided that this was my last time to do something other than science. So I was a history honors major, I was an English minor, I dabbled in Russian and French literature.
And where were you going to college?
I went to New York University. And I graduated with a Bachelor of Arts. And with just those four science courses that were the minimum requirements for some medical schools in the country, I went to Tufts Medical School.
And what year did you enter medical school?
1964.
And where, had you grown up in New York?
Yes. The Tufts Medical School is in Boston.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that was your first move to Boston.
Yes.
That was your first move.
And I was young. I was 19. And found a number of things distressing. Paramount among these was I had always been used to excelling academically, and I found that I did not excel in medical school. Perhaps, or perhaps not related to that, I objected to the teaching method, basically learning the Krebs cycle, memorization. And beyond that, I have to say, I thought I had different reasons for wanting to enter the field of medicine than I found was true of some of my classmates. I realized this was not for me. At the end of the year, my advisor suggested I meet with the dean. I met with the dean and said, my friends say just stick it out, because after the second year of so-called culture courses, then you're in the clinical environment, and things are very different. And the dean said to me, if you're not sure that this is what you want, get out. There are 10 people for everybody that we can accept who's dying to be here. I'm not sure that's the answer I really wanted to get, but I thought about it and decided, all right, I'll approach this somewhat differently. I will go into law and medicine, which, strangely enough, I did. So I'll try to now speed up a little bit, but I thought that was probably useful in answering your question and actually relates directly to what happened to me, because when I was in my last year of law school, I had learned about the National Institute of Mental Health. And naive that I was, I wrote to the director of the National Institute of Mental Health saying, here I am, graduating law school, interest in science, Bronx High School of Science, for high school, so I know science, I know a lot about science, went to medical school for a year, so I have some modest understanding of medical education, and would like to work in law and medicine.
And where did you go to law school? Also in Boston?
Boston University. Yeah, that was an easy choice because while I was in my first year, my only year at Tufts Medical School, I decided this isn't working out. And I took the law boards in February or March, and Boston University did not require an interview or any essays. So I just filled out an application, sent it in, thought, if I need this, I'll have it done. Mm-hmm.
And while in law school, had you done any health or law or health policy? Did that exist at the time?
No, it did not exist. There was an individual at Harvard named Curran who was doing law and medicine.
Is that C-U-R-R-A-N?
Yes. But I did not approach him or say, could I work on whatever you're working on? But because I learned about that, more precisely, through learning about that, I then knew about NIMH.
I see.
So in law school, I really had a detour, but I think that doesn't relate to your interview. I decided while I was in law school that I was going to go in the Foreign Service and actually pursued that route through getting a preceptor and being accepted to the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. But
you didn't end up going.
Did not. I got deferred.
All right. So you wrote to the director of NIMH.
Yes.
It was who?
Stanley Yeltsin.
Interesting. Okay. And what did he?
I'm not sure, but he wrote back. I got a form letter saying, essentially, don't call us, we'll call you.
Uh-huh.
What I did not know was that there was a freeze on civilian employment. This was during the time of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
What I also did not know was that he had a number of special assistants, including what I would call, when I got there, his real special assistant, Dr. John Adams, a psychiatrist who died tragically young at around age 50. David Musto, a psychiatrist who was the historian writing up the history of NIMH, and now, of course, David is at Yale. A psychologist, clinical psychologist, an educational psychologist, and he thought, I subsequently learned, of course, subsequently learned, a lawyer and somebody who knows this might be interesting. And what I also did not know, but proved critical, was his wife was the director of Commission Corps personnel. There are 7 uniformed services in this country. 4 of them are military services. And then there are 3 other uniformed services, one of which is the United States Public Health Service. Started in 1798, if I remember correctly.
Do you recall her name?
Sure. Her name was Dr. Tamarath Yolis. So I imagine, and I don't know, that they had some conversation. When I got to NIMH, I realized that mail was sent to different people to write a letter for GASP, the signature of somebody else. I'm sure he saw that letter. Whether he saw it before it was signed or after doesn't much matter. But in any event, he saw it, must have discussed with his wife, gee, wouldn't this be interesting? And long story short, I received an offer. Would I come to work for NIMH, specifically as a special assistant to its director, through the Commission Corps of the United States Public Health Service? So that is how I came there, because of my initial interest in psychiatry. 1 year of medical school, deciding I wanted to do something in law and medicine.
It's a very unusual story.
Yes, but I think my career has been very unusual for someone with my background.
Yes. Now, you didn't have any special interest or knowledge of drug addiction?
None.
Or abuse?
None. Nothing. Nothing professionally, or can I say professionally, nothing academically, nothing personally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Families, friends, anyone.
Yep, and that's also that's a pretty common story. So what year did you go to NIMH?
1968.
Okay. And what did you do there initially?
Initially, I was special assistant to the director. Well, there's actually a story there, too. When I was interviewed for the job, and perhaps before the interview, maybe that's why I was called in. I said that I wanted to be the ombudsman for patients at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. While in law school, I wrote a book review of a book by Walter Gellhorn called Ombudsman. I can't remember the exact name, but must have been a new book, so 67, 68. And decided that's an interesting concept. At the time, the National Institute of Mental Health administered, I'm not sure if I have a better verb, St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Mm-hmm. St. Elizabeth's Hospital, founded in the 1850s, with the best curative and enlightened treatment of the mentally ill. Well, I didn't know the term case manager. When I talked about ombudsman, I realized I'd be on the payroll of NIMH. I didn't really see myself, though, as somebody dealing with commitment procedures. I saw myself rather as, when somebody was getting ready to leave the hospital, what kind of services, supportive services, needed to be provided. This was a time, 1968, where Medicare was recently enacted in 1965. Medicaid was recently enacted in 1965. I was unaware when I wrote the letter about the community mental health legislation of 63 for construction and 65 for staffing, and indeed 68 for a part for alcohol and drug abuse services. But I thought if I could work with individuals and help them navigate finding employment, perhaps vocational, education, training, housing, reintegration with family. And that was the position that Stanley Yopas agreed with me in the spring before I came there. That would be my job. So you asked me, what did I do? I come to NIMH my first day and find that my boss is on vacation. So I didn't see him for 2 or 3 weeks. When I did see him, I found out that the job I thought we had agreed to was not the job I was going to have. Why? In 1966 or 67, Stanley Yopas and some others went on a mission to the Soviet Union. This was to see if psychiatry was being used properly or misused with so-called dissidents. In any event, leaving that fascinating story for another day, one of the people on the group was David Bazelon. David Bazelon, the chief judge of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, who was a member of the National Advisory Mental Health Council. After my April offer, and before I came there in July, apparently at some time, Stanley Yopas told David Bazelon about his new special assistant, incipient special assistant, and what role I would have, and Bazelon, apparently, see, I never spoke directly to David Bazelon, Judge Bazelon, said, you can't have him do that, it's a conflict of interest. They both thought that I wanted to deal with the commitment side. Of course, that would be a conflict of interest. In any event, would it still be a conflict of interest if they understood what I wanted to work on? Would it have been different if I were called case manager? Would they have suggested maybe go work for the legal services, which was at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. In fact, one of the heads of legal services is now Judge Colleen Collar-Catelli in the District of Columbia. But in any event, I was told, so what was my job? Well, the primary initial role was to develop the legislation for reconfiguration of St. Elizabeth's Hospital as a hospital to a model for research, prevention, training, and treatment.
Okay. at the time was St. Elizabeth's. There was a research unit at St. Elizabeth's.
Absolutely.
That was an NIMH like Lexington, mm-hmm. like the ARC at Lexington.
Right. Right.
Was it Overhauser? Who ran that? What was it called? So at the time, it was similar. There was a small research effort there,
yes.
but most of it was basically custodial. Was that the case at St. Elizabeth's?
All I knew when I came there was that, yes, primarily the hospital was seen as a traditional mental hospital to which people had been committed.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them for many, many years, some small number in John Howard Pavilion, criminally insane, mm-hmm. was the terminology at the time. Yes, there were training efforts too. There was a training division with Dr. Catherine Beardsley. I remember at least her name. I don't know who else was there. Prevention, actually, I'm probably getting ahead of myself. Prevention was probably not a term that was used then.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a correction, I'm sure. It was just to be a national center for services, research, and training. Prevention was something that really came when Jimmy Carter came, and that's a different kind of
later.
Yeah, later.
In the mental health field.
Yes.
And so what were your... Did you actually spend time at St. Elizabeth's?
Yes, but not exactly related to this.
Mm-hmm.
I found that I had to find ways to spend my time. I was working on this project, and that was fine. And in working on it, I worked with, or not precisely with, but gave my work products to Dr. Sherman Kiefer, who was the head of that division, which was the drug abuse. Now, what was he at that point? I don't know.
Yeah,
for some reason, he was the one to whom I had to give my work.
Was it Donata?
Donata.
Within
NIMH. But I don't think, I was in NIMH, he was in NIMH, he was a division director, but I'm wondering,
I think it
in
was
1968,
yeah, it was
why
Donata.
It would have been that he was the person, unless it had nothing to do with drug abuse specifically, because the assignment had nothing to do with drug abuse specifically. It was hospital
right.
related. But I was not overly busy. Dr. Yolas had me go on a couple of trips with him. One was to the Kinsey Institute for, what's the precise name?
We can get that.
Kinsey Institute. The idea was that this was 1968. There were student riots. It was an issue that what if students at the at Indiana University burned the building in which Kinsey Institute was housed, and this unique collection of mm-hmm. materials would be destroyed.
Had there been a threat?
I don't
had
know.
Somebody just cooked up this idea?
Dr. Yolas and Dr. John Adams and I went there, and I think they made the right decision that we did not need to microfiche this entire collection. A more interesting trip, a little more interesting in a very different way. This is not for your interview, but I mean, I led a very sheltered life, and I was still very young, and this was kind of overload and saturation. After an hour, I didn't need to be there the rest of the day. I knew my answer. One trip was to the Federal Medical Center in Springfield, Missouri. A very interesting place where these were federal prisoners got psychiatric care. Now, perhaps most interesting in that trip was not the trip itself, although it helped me be able to start thinking about and asking questions like, if the staff has been here on average 15 years, and I'm not saying that was right, I don't remember, it was a long time, mm-hmm. I thought there must not be as many challenges to this kind of work as I might have assumed. And what does that mean in terms of what the inmates are saying? But the most interesting part was that a judge from Minnesota decided on his own that he wanted to go see this facility, and he was on the visit the same time Dr. Yolis and I was. And this was then Judge Blackmun, later Supreme Court Justice Blackmun, became very interested. For a while I kept up a correspondence with him, but all before he came to Washington. But to me, the fact that this judge wanted to know what was the facility like, what was the treatment like to which he was sentencing individuals, I thought was very, very fascinating. He had been affiliated, associated with the Mayo Clinic in Rochester in some form. So clearly he was more savvy than most judges would be about those issues. And St. Elizabeth's Hospital. One day a week I went to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, but not because of my assignment. In 1968, President Nixon had called for the District of Columbia the crime capital of America. And the District of Columbia was increasing their number of police. In the year that I came, there were 39 different classes of police cadets who graduated after a 13-week program. The cadets spent one day of their 13 weeks at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. In the morning, they got a lecture on D.C. commitment law, and they heard from a psychiatrist or a psychologist about perhaps how that law related to their patients. I'm being a little vague here because I'll tell you why in a minute. After that, they had a walk around the grounds of the hospital. This turned out to be my favorite part. Who were the patients and who were the staff? And then their favorite part, the afternoon, was spent with Jim Ennis in psychodrama, where they role-played. Now, there were 39 graduating classes of D.C. police. There were Park Police. There were U.S. Secret Service. There were others. Almost every week, there was a class coming there. And I gave the lecture on D.C. commitment law. But 9 times out of 10, the psychiatrist or psychologist did not show up. And I also spoke about mental illness, factors on individuals who were there, how they ran afoul of the law or civil commitment or what have you. My favorite part indeed was walking around with them. And during that part, I would get questions like, where do we get our bounty for turning in patients? Those were, I mean, some of the questions were, of course, very intelligent and thoughtful, but others showed why there was a value to this. Perhaps the most value was not in what I was saying, but being able to negate false, incorrect information or perceptions. And perceptions, that was the value of the tour. Staff did not wear uniforms, mostly. And patients did not have to wear garb other than their own. Perhaps because many of the staff made a low wage and didn't have clothing of the sort that people who had higher incomes could make, it may have been easy at first blush to confuse people. But then to observe behavior and to see that, I thought it was a very valuable lesson to people about essentially there but for the grace of God. Or to look at people as individuals and try to understand who they are and their strengths. Yeah. And the psychodrama where they got to role play. The individual who called the police to say, my, let's say, husband is threatening me. The husband, the police officer, things of that nature. I need to back up a little bit because this is okay. In my 1 year of medical school, there was, it was a very unusual curriculum. And I don't know if it was experimental, if they kept or not, but in any event, we had something like 12 hours of psychiatry. But I decided to become a volunteer at Boston State Hospital.
Ah.
Which was the mental hospital.
Yes.
And an outpatient was, I'm not sure the right verb is assigned to me, but when I came there, my one day a week, I dealt with this person. This helped to sensitize me, not just to what her issues were and what she was dealing with, but the absurdity of my having access to patient records and the naivete, not just of me, but of others, about the bond that the two of us would forge such that when I was leaving at the end of that year, going home for the summer, it turned out to be more than the summer, she had a reaction to that. That really had a profound influence on me. Mm-hmm. Just to talk about absurdity of medical education, perhaps this is not so absurd. In your first year already, you are given from a pharmaceutical company, you know, bag, stethoscope, this, that, and the other thing. The lab coat, I'm sure I had just for the lab courses, but in my little stint at Boston City Hospital, being all of 19 years old, or maybe 20 by this time, I don't remember, wearing this coat and being introduced as Dr. Milstein, not first-year medical students, so just the issues and the way we deal with individuals and patients. So, okay, I've gone kind of afield, but I thought that was interesting. So I went to St. Louis Hospital for that, and that's how I got to meet Dr. Beardsley. I don't know why, in the training, perhaps related to the work I was doing with legislation. And got to meet Winnie Nash, who then, at that time, was the head of the, I'm sorry, I don't have the exact name, but today it would be she was the hospital lawyer. She was employed by the hospital.
Okay.
And she wanted to actually videotape my lecture on law, and if they're going to videotape, they can get a psychiatrist or psychologist to do that part. I wanted to go beyond that, which I thought, if she actually meant this seriously, but I just thought, oh my lord, wanted to have a reenactment of the McNaughton rule and how it was enacted, and I said, are you going to play Queen Victoria? And she said, why not? And we laughed about that, but that never happened. After a while, perhaps 9 months, while I maintained the title of Special Assistant, I went to work for the Legislative Services Branch in NIMH. Headed up by at that time, her name was Rolly Lowenstein, R-O-L-L-E-E. This was a wonderful experience for me because, well, this is probably not stuff that you need to know. I mean, it's useful for your interview, but all right, I'll finish the sentence. Because I knew if I gave her something, it had to be really my best work. So before I would submit something, I'd look at this and say, all right, now that I've written it, can I put on a different hat if I were reviewing this, and what can it be? And it really was tremendously helpful to me in all of my life to know that when I wrote something, I wanted to say, is this clear? Is this comprehensive? Is it understandable? I guess that's clear. Does it make a point? Does it have a bottom line? Does it suggest where we go from here? So that was a...
And so what kinds of things were you writing?
Well, we were called Legislative Services. Now, one thing that Rolly did but kept the rest of us out of, thankfully, was, one thing was that she wrote a piece of legislation that said, I mean, she can't write legislation, but she wrote a draft bill which somebody got to somebody on the Hill. This is now 1969. It is a Democratic Congress, it is a Republican administration. The agency, of course, is nonpartisan. but there were concerns, perhaps based on grant awards made under parts of the Community Mental Health Centers Act, about which applicants were receiving grants, that politics was playing a role. And Raleigh wrote this draft bill that was by somebody, given to somebody on the Hill, that was enacted into law, that said that no grant shall be made by the National Institute of Mental Health unless there is approval by the National Advisory Mental Health Council. How Raleigh survived that, I don't know, because when it became public, there was an uproar, but the uproar related mostly to the director. That was strike number one, and strike number two was that he was seen by people in the Nixon administration, particularly John Mitchell, as soft on drugs, and he was relieved of his job as director.
And then Burt Brown?
Burt Brown, who was the deputy director, became director. So Raleigh wrote legislation. Now,
was he soft on drugs?
He had a different point of view about drugs. He is a psychiatrist. He was a clinician. In fact, a lot of people at NIMH, like C. Marchetti, he won a Nobel Prize, didn't he, C. Marchetti? Did he win a Nobel Prize, C. Marchetti? Maybe it was Axelrod.
He did not, but I know.
C. Marchetti thought, you know, this guy paid way too much attention to services, treatment, not research. Now, I think, you know, terminology has its own life, has its own baggage. What does terms mean? I know what people mean when they say soft on drugs. But I think what he was looking at was a public health point of view and a focus on individuals. And certainly from his job, it wasn't his thought processes, I'm sure, to think about interdiction, Coast Guard, Justice Department, things of that nature.
So had you... I mean, NIMH was largely responsible at that point for funding drug research, research on drug abuse, et cetera.
Yes, there was no NIDA.
What did you know about that from your position? When did you begin to know something about drug abuse as a field?
Much later. I came to NIMH because I was interested in mental health. They included within mental health alcoholism and drug addiction. Whether we could have debates other times about should those have been subsumed, but if not, you know, where is a better home? This is a part also from the whole issues for drug abuse and medicalization, and should it even be in an agency? And NIMH, by the way, was going through its own identity crisis. It had been part of NIH from its establishment in 1946, one of the early institutes, actually. And in 1967, before I came, became an independent agency apart from NIH. I don't know, I only know secondhand, you know, why that happened, what the intention was, but that lasted 11 months. And then it was made part of this new Services Administration, but given the mental health was added to the name, so it was Health Services and Mental Health Administration. And that didn't last that many years. And so, you know, when I was there, that's what we were part of. And my interest was mental health. I was working on legislation for San Francisco Hospital. I was giving lectures on commitment law. I was writing about commitment laws in other jurisdictions. I was looking at bills introduced in the House and Senate that might relate to mental health, and wrote up the branch put out four times a year something called periodic summaries of mental health legislation about the bills that were introduced, what they would do, and then at the end of each year a compilation of what was enacted.
So let me just check. Okay, so 1967, NIMH is split off from NIH.
Right. And this I only learned. And I'm not there.
Right. But when you were there, it's what?
It was just become part of Health Services and Mental Health Administration.
Health Services and Mental Health Admin. HISMA. Okay.
Health Services and they pronounce it HISMA for some reason. Okay.
Okay.
But the intention is, here's an agency that's part of NIH, the Research Institute's home, and now is in a home that focuses on services. Mm-hmm. Was that a reflection of what the budget had become? Was it, I don't really know. It certainly fit Yolis better, although I know, just from looking at his bio, he had done research in Delphi, Maryland, and some child now health center or something like that, but, mm-hmm. yeah.
And he'd been at Lexington as a psychiatrist.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So do you think that the, just to kind of finish that bit out, I understand it's secondhand, but the Nixon administration was gunning for, really looking for a reason to split drug abuse out of NIMH?
I have no idea. I have no idea.
It certainly later appears.
I don't think so. Well, let's see. Let's see. Within NIMH, drug abuse component, as well as the alcohol abuse component, began as sections within this division of special mental health programs that Mort Miller was the director of. Mm-hmm. And then there was the, just for drug abuse now, this Sonata, was that the name?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But that division of narcotic addiction and drug abuse, I guess. And then during the Nixon administration, the Special Action Office Bill 92-255, I don't know why I remember that, Public Law 92-255, which established the Special Action Office on Drug Abuse Prevention, also had a title that said, effective this date, December 31st. I'll come to the year in a minute. There shall be established a National Institute on Drug Abuse.
Yeah.
The reason I have to think of the year is when we talk about the 35th anniversary of NIDA,
yeah.
I think people look at that date, but actually, administratively, it was established earlier by executive order.
Yes, that date, it was established before that date, which was, I think, 74.
Yeah, whatever the date was in the law, it was established earlier. Right?
Yes.
So sometime in 73, there just was an executive order that established it.
Yes, okay.
So should NIDA have celebrated its 36th anniversary? Whatever.
Yeah, it's crazy, these years. Right, okay. So the executive order actually established it in 73.
Yeah. Now I have to tell you that my interests, if you were to have asked me this question, were primarily mental health, secondly alcohol, and third drug abuse. Mental health was just something that I thought I knew, and that's why I came there. Alcoholism, I found a fascinating set of issues because is it legal? Is it illegal? For whom is it legal? Under what circumstances? And drug abuse was something that I didn't know and just seemed to have all this Sturm und Drang associated with it.
Indeed.
Right? So I really think, unfortunately, for your purposes, that it's going to be many years later, or several years later anyway, before
It's actually really helpful to kind of go through this from a very different perspective than I'm used to, because if you center drug abuse, things look different than if you have this focus on mental health, and you see drug abuse as kind of part of that until a certain point, when it becomes this front burner kind of issue, and there is contestation over is it going to stay in NIMH, and a lot of folks, Jaffe, etc., did not want it to stay in NIMH. They wanted to get it out of NIMH, and they did. So it's a kind of interesting. I mean, that's an interesting story.
another interesting story, but I think it's not for what you're looking at, is how the Alcohol Institute had been established, mm-hmm. but as an institute within the NIMH.
Right. That is a very different genealogy
so
in 1970.
Yes. Even when that was an institute, it was an institute within an institute.
Yes.
Yeah. And drug abuse, so I guess they want to make sure, based on what you're saying.
Now, you did have something. I mean, tell me about ADAMHA, because there does become...
Okay. So I'm working in... as a special assistant genealogist, but now spending more of my time working in legislative services and continuing the St. Elizabeth's Hospital day a week because I enjoyed that so much and felt that it had a value. I'm doing more in legislation, and legislation, the name was somewhat of a misnomer, legislative services branch. There is a general counsel in the department, and there are different divisions of general's counsel, and there was a public health division, and people were supposed to ask their legal questions to general counsel. But what we did in legislative services branch, and I can say it now, is we asked people in NIMH to come to us first so that we could shape the question they wanted to ask. There's one thing you learn in law school, it's don't ask a question the answer to which you don't know. And don't be surprised. And basically, I think our job is working with programs to be able to say, okay, there are some questions we have. What is the question? And how do we want to frame it? There weren't things that were going on that were illegal. I don't mean to say that. Mm-hmm. But, much later, if you remind me, I'll tell you something relating to this. When I was at the White House at a cabinet meeting discussing drug abuse, when I was in the White House Drug Abuse Policy Office. So it's not really illegal, it's just knowing or legal.
That was in the 80s?
Yeah,
when
I was
there
in the second Reagan administration. I was there from January 87 until March 88.
Okay. So we'll come back when we get to that.
Can I just take a break?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so relieved.
I've seen you looking at it.
I'm looking opposed to trying to figure it out. All right. So we were talking about ADAMHA, I think. That's where we were.
Okay. HISMA did not last long, and then this ADAMHA came out.
Yes.
Because, in part, we now had, you had these new institutes set up, Alcohol Independent Institute.
In 1970, right?
1973.
Alcohol?
Oh, alcohol.
Alcohol.
Sorry. But ADAMHA.
Yes.
Yeah. And there's now going to be an independent agency just looking at alcohol, drug abuse, and mental health in all its varieties. I had been, by this time, the acting chief of the legislative services branch of NIMH. Raleigh Lowenstein left, and I became acting chief, and then before the reorganization. And when the reorganization occurred, I became chief of a newly established legislative services unit in ADAMHA. So the purview would be legislation now for all three programs. Of course, you might say, that NIMH encompassed drug and alcohol in a different format isn't any different, but now that they're independent institutes, they have larger budgets. They have their own staff who can do legislation, too. And my job is, in some ways, to develop legislative proposal specifications for legislation that we think we would want to suggest to our hierarchical levels to present to the Congress. Did I have a real knowledge or interest in drug abuse in this time, 73? I don't think so. Certainly I knew the legislative bills that were coming mm-hmm. through. I knew the proposals that were happening. within ADMHA, I was in the administrator's small staff that met. But I don't really recall that I was at meetings with other institute people at higher levels. This was an independent unit. It's a strange terminology, but the people who were deciding on the ADMHA structure for the Office of Administrator decided they didn't want me and my unit to be part, be a branch reporting to a division director who would report to the administrator. They wanted me to be able to report directly to the administrator. And because of that, over time...
Who was that, the administrator?
Well, we had a very interesting number of administrators. Let's see. Was the first one Bob DuPont, who lasted just a very short time, allegedly because Senator Javits wanted him to give up his outside practice, and he would not. We had Roger Eggerberg, who had been an assistant secretary for health, become the interim administrator, and that lasted about 9 months. Am I forgetting somebody before Jim Isbister took that role? Jim Isbister had been deputy director of NIMH starting in his early 30s. Just a brilliant man. And so Jim was there, I think, until Jerry Clareman came later. But it was under Isbister that he started giving me other kinds of things to work on that I would say were more policy. He had a another unit, another. It wasn't called a unit. He had a an office. I guess that's the terminology. In the Office of the Administrator, you have offices, not divisions. He had an office that dealt with policy, but based on personnel at that time, he increasingly gave me.
When did that start? When?
This was probably around 74, 75. So I'm sure, unfortunately, I don't remember specifics, but I'm sure this is when I had my introduction to drug abuse policy issues. Of course, they always were involved because of legislation, but in a different kind of, from a different kind of look at the elephant. In 77, Jimmy Carter was inaugurated, elected in 76, inaugurated in 77, and decided that he was going to have a President's Commission on Mental Health. I worked on detail for the President's Commission on Mental Health. They asked me to be their staff liaison for legal and ethical issues, and I said I would only do it if they also let me do that for prevention. And they agreed. And I also became de facto parliamentarian. Well, the fact is, of course, there was a lot of interest. A new president, a new commission. And I remember that Ray Herbert, W-R-A-Y, Herbert, who wrote for the Psychological Monitor, had an article early in 78 referring to me as the brains behind the operation, which was not true, but you know when they say you can't go home again? Well, suddenly in ADMHA, where I had been the head of legislation, and yes, also involved in policy, now suddenly I had this increased cachet, or perhaps was viewed as having skills or knowledge or talents that perhaps I had more in view, or perhaps I didn't have. But in any event, the President's Commission on Mental Health was set up to be a one-year operation. And basically was. It was a couple of months afterwards. But when I came back to ADMHA, I think some people had a different view of what I was. Now, unnecessary for your story, I was brought back early because the new administrator, Clareman, got into a brouhaha at a Senate hearing with Senator Mikulski and decided that the fault wasn't his, but the person who was acting head of legislative services. So I had to come back immediately. But within a very short time, I became associate administrator for, and here's where I can get these titles, and I will, but between 78 and 85, I had three or four different titles. But it was the person in the office of the administrator who was associate administrator for planning, policy analysis, program analysis, program coordination. Yes, legislation was within there. Communications and public affairs sometimes was within there. So had a very much broadened role. And of course, starting at that time, of course, I was involved not just in the administrator's office, the administrator, small staff, but whenever the administrator would meet with senior people from the institutes on any major issue. Let's say Bill Pollan would come with Dick Lindblad, and I would be there.
So that's how you got to know more of the sort of drug policy field.
And, it's okay.
Okay. So, you went to the White House policy office.
Well, that was later.
Okay.
This was during the Carter administration in his first year when he set up the commission. I went there. So I was actually one of the very early ones there. I was there from March or April of 77. The commission gave its report in April or May the following year, and I had to come back, I think, in March, just a little bit early, but wasn't there for the final report presentation to the president and things of that nature.
Right, right.
No one thought that Adam Ho was going to last more than a few years. And it actually did last.
12 years?
Let's see. It was, when did we say it was established? In 73. And it was around until SAMHSA was founded.
So eight.
It really lasted 80? A long time. Let's see.
88?
SAMHSA was founded after I was in NIDA already. That was probably, it was like 90s.
Early 1990s.
Yeah.
Early 1990s.
Yeah, so that lasted for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
So I was in these different roles. As I said, basically it was the same role.
Right. But why did it seem like Adam Hall wouldn't last? Why did people feel that, do you think?
People thought that to have one agency with all these different tensions, mental health versus alcohol versus drugs. Remember, alcohol kept saying, don't lump us with drugs. We're the legal people. We don't need to be tainted with the stigma that adheres not just to drug addicts, but also to clinicians, but as well to drug abusers, to researchers. We don't need that, thank you very much. And prevention, very different for alcoholism than for drug abuse. And try to create whatever. Then, if you want to have a 3x3 matrix, or maybe 3x4 now, the tensions weren't just in the one dimension of alcohol, drugs, mental health. Tensions also were research, services, training, prevention, not so much, services and research. A terrible tension, increasing tension as this went on, perhaps because of the growth of the parent movement, which I was a sideliner. This all happened to NIDA, before I was at NIDA, talking about, what's happening to our children. Talking about research. That's why I think people thought it wasn't going to last very long. What it did was say, okay, we're taking you out of what then became the Health Services Administration and the Health Resources Administration, which now, of course, is HRSA, Health Resources and Services Administration. But, so the tension tensions were it wasn't going to last. So I had these 7 years where I was the head, if you will, the main head, if you will, mm-hmm. thinking person in terms of policy issues. Mm-hmm. And then what happened? We had a new administration, but it didn't happen right away. We had a new administration. Clearman left. Bud Mayer came as administrator. But then after Mayer left, Mac McDonald came. Donald E. McDonald came as administrator. I guess he must have come in the last year of the first Reagan term, or the next to last year of the first Reagan term. So that would be 83 or 84 that he came. And there's almost always a tension between career and political people. In his case, Mac was told before he came, here's some management books to read, and bring somebody with you that you trust. Okay, and I know this from him. I caped up with him. I just had lunch with him last week. Okay. Career people have this feeling, some of them, that these people come in, they're here for a short time, they're adding something to their resume, they're not going to stay, and they never really want to get to know how government works. Okay? Which can be equally as bad in terms of relationships. All right. Here comes McDonald, pediatrician. Okay? He's never administered anything else. Comes in, by the way, as all people do, with a reputation. What was his reputation? He got the job because of his or his wife's connection to Republican politics in Florida, and he's a religious zealot. Okay, and he came in as somebody interested because one of his own children had an issue with drugs. Okay,
religious zealot, Christian.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. This is the poop. Okay. He comes in and he has his first meetings with the staff. And I can't remember if it was the first meeting or the second meeting or whatever. And he says, what are the things that you want to do? Or something like that. And nobody says anything. Okay. And he has this individual meeting with me and he said, what the things that you're interested in? I said, I'm interested in youth suicide. He said, why does nobody answer me at the meeting? I said, because you're new and you're told not to trust us and you're told that we have our own agenda. And really our agenda is to make sure that what you want to get done is what gets done. So people are saying, what, I'm going to tell him what I want and he's going to think that's not what I want and he's not working for me? Well, what I'm trying to say is we developed a relationship such that I don't think confidant is too strong a word. And I kept my job as associate administrator, but also had this second role as, I don't know what to call it exactly. Advisor to the administrator. Sometimes it was informal, but most. And it was kind of great. I mean, we would meet, the two of us, like the two of us are meeting now, and we start talking about certain kinds of things. And I would do what I called my Hewlett-Packard, you know, what if. Ask different kinds of questions to, I was hoping, help maybe see the issue from a different... But when I say that, that sounds like I had a major role. When I say hoping to, I wanted to see, help this man who basically said, I've never run anything. I need to understand how to replace and how things are going. And he thought out loud. And then I would hear what he said and I'd send something in writing to him. And he'd mark it up and send it back to me and I'd send it back to him. And at some point when his changes seemed to me to be what I had written in an earlier version, I thought, you know, I think we're getting something here. But we had this wonderful relationship because we were able to say in the privacy, I mean, I would never be at a meeting with him where he would say something where I would say either I disagreed. If he would ask in a meeting, of course I would say I disagree. But let's say he's meeting with his institute directors and I think something. I disagree, but not that something's a question of fact. I'd wait to meet with him afterwards and we'd start talking about this. So, why is this important to me? Because Mac McDonald started using me in a broader kind of role. And then was asked to become the Assistant Secretary for Health. Jim Mason had been Assistant Secretary for Health for a long time, wanted to get back to Atlanta and CDC, and Mac was asked to be Acting Assistant Secretary for Health in 1986 and said to me, "Can you come with me?" And I said, "No, I don't want to be a special assistant. I've been a special assistant before, and I've had people as special assistants. And the idea for a special assistant is you're grooming them to become something else." And I got what I wanted. I said, "Well, can you just come for a short while with me?" And I said, "Sure." And that short while came to be the whole time he was there, which was not even quite a year. But that introduced me in a different way, hands-on, to all of health. I mean, even one time when he was called away because his sister died, I think, and he had a meeting of all the heads of the public health service agencies, he said to me, "Will you chair the meeting?" I mean, it was that kind of relationship I had with him, and people knew he had that relationship with me, so kind of trusted me even to do something like that. But of course, in those days, it was dealing with all kinds of issues, Food and Drug Administration issues, dealing with the French versus the U.S. claims about, AIDS and HIV, Gallo versus Montagnier, was that his name? All kinds of issues, and coming hot and heavy. And then when Mac went back to Adama, I came back with him, but very shortly after that, he was asked to become the director of the White House Drug Abuse Policy Office, following Carlton Turner.
Oh, okay.
And of course, he was an administrator, maybe I didn't say this. His interest, of course, came from drug abuse. We hadn't had an administrator before this who came from drug abuse. Some other kinds of concerns, I'm sure people had. Drug abuse, parents movement, what have you. I went with him to the White House and stayed with him his whole time there. He quickly found out, I guess, that the person he brought with him when he came to Adama was not the right person for the job. He said, "Bring someone you trusted." He trusted me, I trusted him. He could trust that I knew what to deal with. Mm-hmm. So he asked me to go with him to the White House. And this was a very interesting time. There had been established something called the National Drug Policy Board. Does that sound right? That was headed up.
Wish Joe were here. He knows all this stuff. So the National Drug Policy Board.
Headed up by Ed Meese.
Yes.
And okay. It was at that time, all I guess what we'd call supply side issues.
Yes. And is Schuster?
Schuster's director.
Director of NIDA at this point.
And I'll come back to Schuster a little later, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think the week we came to the White House in January 87, the National Drug Policy Board, National Drug Enforcement Policy Board was the name, National Drug Enforcement Policy Board. The week we came there, by executive order, that was changed to the National Drug Policy Board and expanded from Coast Guard, Customs, Justice Department, whatever, to include the demand side agencies. And I remember saying to Mac, "Well, wait a minute, you're the White House liaison, what role do you have now? Is this undercutting you?" And he said, "Well, let's just see, that's Mac, we'll see, people are people, I can always deal with people, we'll see how this is." So Ed Meese chaired this National Drug Policy Board, which included demand and supply agencies, and here's Mac, he's a cabinet officer, of course. And here's Mac, with the Drug Abuse Policy Office, which has maybe 11 staff, three of whom are well-connected young women who are given jobs that supposedly are administrative, but they don't have administrative skills because they don't have skills well beyond that, but they want to have something on their resume. A number of people on detail, me from Health and Human Services, one from the Justice Department, one from Coast Guard. But having said that, suffice it to say, I was the only career person on that staff. So now it was a question of my developing trust with people too. And I knew I had it when, on the following January 20th, I was invited to the annual celebration of the inauguration, an event for political people only, which basically is a roast of Democrats without the Democrats being there. So, of course, through here, I was involved in all kinds of issues, drug testing policies, transportation industry, drug-free housing, drug-free schools, as well as the health kinds of it. And what was my job? My job, basically, was to be his eyes and ears and special assistant and come to places. And this is where that interesting, to me, anecdote occurred. Mac invited me to come with him to different meetings, including meetings of the National Drug Policy Board. And at one of these meetings, it was decided that no federal dollars should be used for needle syringe exchange. Okay. I came back and I wrote up a memo to McDonald, and I said, at today's meeting, this is what I heard, and this is what I, well, this is what I heard. I said that part. And then I said, of course, this prohibition does not pertain to research on needle and syringe exchange because the administration needs to have the intelligence upon which to develop policy. He said, well, I'm not sure that I heard that. I said, well, to me that was implicit. And he said, well, I said, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, Mr. Bosch-Schuster, basically saying, this is going to be coming out, but of course it doesn't pertain to research. Well, no one ever questioned it. Research was continued. Nobody said, there was legislation that said no federal dollars may be used to support needle exchange programs. Right?
By that, they meant actual exchange. They didn't mean education or prevention or any of that.
I don't know prevention. They may, So you couldn't get dollars to the actual programs.
Right.
But I said, and it's what I thought they must mean, surely. It wasn't that I was being deceitful. There's a little bit of something here, obviously, but I was thinking they couldn't have meant that. And I was not in a position to ask a question. I'm there as an observer, and I'm not even there to send a note to McDonald's to say, ask this question, in part because I know it's a good lawyer. This is where I'm saying it's a little bit that I'm not being 100% here. If you ask the question, you may be told, oh, of course not, you can't do it. So you don't ask the question.
Now, had needle exchange come up before? That you had you been present at discussions of it?
No,
or?
No. This was just a meeting, and that maybe that's why Mac asked me to come to this meeting, because it was about needle exchange. But it's a fascinating insight, I think, into the way things were working. Another fascinating insight, if you will. While I was there in my last, well, I was only there for 14 months. While I was there, am I directing this interview too much?
What? No, it's fine.
Okay. There was something called the White House Conference for a Drug-Free America.
Yes. In 1988?
Yeah. Its report came out in 88, so maybe it was started in 87. And the individual who was asked to chair that, Dr. Lois Harrington, came to some of these meetings also and presented, and Mac invited me to come to those meetings also. Well, at one of these meetings, I remember, the comment being made that there had been talk, and it was accepted gospel in a lot of quarters, not everywhere, that if you wanted to get treatment for drug abuse, you had to go on a waiting list in a lot of places. Okay, that there weren't enough slots. And that terminology being used, slots, you know, almost like FTEs in a different way. If you have a slot for a year, you're looking for a lot of you have slots during it, and people on waiting lists. And there was also this whole brouhaha about AIDS versus drug abuse.
Yeah. AIDS versus?
Oh, yes, not and drug abuse. AIDS versus drug abuse. Because if you had AIDS and you were a drug abuser and you had a dirty urine, should you be kept in the treatment program? Because if not, you might die or die sooner. But if you're showing that you're not paying any attention to the rules and taking drugs anyway, and somebody's on a waiting list, is it ethical not to treat? Is it ethical not to treat that person in lieu of you? Yeah, that was kind of debate. And here there's a meeting to talk about the White House Conference for Drug Free America. And the statement is made by one of the individuals at this meeting. Anybody, any day in this city can get drug abuse treatment. There are Narcotics Anonymous programs throughout the city, and people can come there anytime. So you see, I'm getting an education different times. This is how some people are thinking. You know, what is treatment? Is treatment different for different people? Does it matter where you are in your drug abuse career? If you've tried to stop before, you know, where have you been? What your drug of abuse is? You know, your sex, your ethnicity, your age. Okay. Okay. Now, I'm here having this jolly good old time, but it's now 1988. And there's going to be an election in November. And sometime very early in 1988, there's going to be a television debate between, it's a television debate, but a debate anyway, between, as I recall, six or so different candidates for the Republican nomination for president. This is, of course, Reagan's second term. One of the candidates is George H.W. Bush. He's vice president. One of his staff people goes to McDonald and makes a request. McDonald comes to me and says, I need you to get from NIDA Lloyd Johnston's latest numbers for the Monitoring the Future study. I said, I can't do this. Call me a subordinate, but I cannot do this. Mm-hmm. I am not a political person. I am a career person. That information is not released. You're asking me to get that information. Give it to this guy who's the speechwriter for Bush. I can't do it. He understood. To his credit, he understood immediately. But I started thinking. And I went to him next week and I said, I need to leave here. So we need to leave here. I said, it's already becoming uncomfortable for me. And then I had to work backwards. And, you know, could you see me being here, you know, during the election? You know, can you see me being here, you know, after the conventions? And he decided, yes. So, you know, I started thinking about what I wanted to do. And then, I guess you'll have to insert questions here, I'm sorry. And then,
I will.
Bob Schuster approached me and said, I'm realizing now I'm off a few months. This must have happened toward the end of 87 because Bob Schuster invited me to a New Year's party in his house, New Year's Day party, at which, while I was at a buffet table facing the wall, he comes up behind me, puts his arm on me, and says, so, how would you like to be my deputy director? And I said, oh, that sounds interesting. And he left. And I went home and said to my wife, I don't know what this means. Does he? Now, what I did know was that, and we're talking before about SAMHSA, that before SAMHSA was set up, there was set up the OSAP and the OTI, the Office for Substance Abuse Prevention, and the Office for Treatment Improvement. And Mac is still, even though he's at the White House, he's still administrator of Atomo. He's going to be setting up these versions. And so Mac, when he hears from me, he says, okay, why don't you become director of OSAP? I said, no. He said, you can't talk about this. I'm coming back. We'll come back in 2 weeks. And, okay, well, I did not talk about it. I did not. But he did. And one of the people to whom he spoke was Schuster. Now, Elaine Johnson was deputy director. Mac already had asked Elaine to be the head of OSAP. I know this because she came to me to say, what do you think? Isn't this a god-awful job? And I said, no, I don't think it really is. Elaine, why do you think that? Your deputy director here is setting something off? Okay. But then, when Mac offered it to me, even though I didn't say it, he said it to other people. One was Schuster, maybe one was Elaine Johnson. Mm-hmm. But then Schuster, maybe, or maybe Schuster said to Elaine, Elaine calls me, Duke, how about we swap jobs? The swap jobs, you want to come to the White House? No, no, no. What if I take the, oh, I said, yeah, anyway, it was all this kind of stuff. I don't even know, I don't know, and I don't, I never did ask to find out exactly, maybe I never could have found out what actually happened. But Schuster asked me to come to work for him. Now, since I already was in the senior executive service in the government, this is just something that doesn't have to be advertised. The secretary has to agree. It took a few months, but that happened. Okay, now why was Schuster interested in me? You could say it's because I was with Mac at the White House. Certainly that had to help knowing about substance abuse, drug abuse from a national perspective.
It had to have been the needle exchange memo.
No, I don't think that was it either. I think this really was it. Early on, when I was Mac's confidant and Schuster was deputy, was director of NIDA, he said to me, Dick, I need you to come to my next one-on-one with Mac. I said, your next one-on-one by definition? He said, I cannot understand that man. I can't do what he says. I said, okay. Can you tell Mac in advance you want me there? I said, sure. I go to the meeting. Okay. At the end of the meeting, Schuster goes, you see what I mean? I said, Bob, slow down. You heard what he said. Those are ideas in progress. Okay? He's not asking you to do anything illegal. If he were, you'd have to say, I can't do that. He's not asking you to do anything unethical. If he had to, you could do that. He's telling you something that he wants done. But now you have to think about, okay, this is what you said you want done, but this is what I think you mean, and this. He said, but that would be insubordinate. I said, no, it's not. We should go back to him. Well, anyway, Schuster learned that I was somebody who could run interference. Now, whether he thought, I'm not jumping, I could be his deputy director because I could get along with this man and his role of how he and I, he would now, perhaps differently than under Elaine, have NIDA run, I don't know. But basically, I think when I was there with him, it gave him a lot more freedom and flexibility to know he had a guy who knew policy and legislation and had a relationship with the guy and could trust me. I'd never go to Mac before I went to him, but if we had to develop, you know, our request for appropriations or anything else, that he had more flexibility to do other kinds of things.
Yeah, so. That's great. Yeah.